Hello and welcome to the next episode of History Hormonos with Tom and Simon. I'm Simon, and my brother Tom is also with me today. And as in previous episodes, we're going to be reviewing a book, this time chosen by me. The book in question today is The Vanquished by Robert Garrard. Subtitled Why the First World War Failed to End. It's published by Penguin Books in 2017, and it covers the years immediately following the end of the First World War in Eastern Europe and the Middle East, exploring in particular the reasons why violence and instability continued after the armistice of 1918. The book is very broad in scope, covering a wide geographical area over a 6-year period, but with a particular focus on the fates of the four great powers active in those regions, each of whom were shattered by their experiences during the First World War. Garrard divides his narrative into three key themes: defeat, revolution and counter-revolution, and imperial collapse. As I felt, these themes worked well in making sense of the confused interwar period in Eastern Europe and the Middle East. I thought it was best that we use the same themes to guide our book review. Just a quick note before we start as well. This book links very well with several other ones that we've reviewed on History Hermanos, particularly Ring of Steel by Alexander Watson and The Fall of the Ottomans by Eugene Rogan, and also The Hitler Myth by Ian Kershaw. So we'll go straight into part one, which focuses or is themed around the topic of defeat. Although Russia fought against Germany, Austria-Hungary, and the Ottoman Empire during the First World War, the Russian Empire shared the experience of defeat with her enemies. Following the Russian Revolution and subsequent Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, the new Bolshevik government surrendered vast swathes of territory formerly belonging to the Russian Empire to the Central Powers, which we've previously discussed in Ring of Steel and the Fall of the Ottomans. The defeat of Russia freed up soldiers and resources for a renewed German offensive on the Western Front, Operation Michael, and there are high hopes that the Spring 1918 offensive, along with a significant Austrian victory over the Italians at the Battle of Caporetto, would bring the war to a successful conclusion for the Central Powers. In the event, however, both the Spring Offensive on the Western Front and the Battle of Caporetto ended in devastating reverses for both Germany and Austria-Hungary and precipitated a collapse of morale at home and on the front, which ultimately ended in revolution in Berlin and Vienna. Following defeat in the Third Battle of Gaza, the heads of the Ottoman government also fled Istanbul. By the 11th of November 1918, the armistice ended fighting on the Western Front. The experience of defeat and revolution, however, meant that in Eastern Europe there was no end to the violence. That was my overview of the first key theme that Garrard discusses. And I felt that he covered that area, that topic fairly well. The book is quite a short one. It's only around 350 pages. The information is quite compact, but I feel like he does write very lucidly and really does pack a lot of detail and information into the account of even quite a small book. But yeah, I felt that he covered that, the topic of defeat and the morale effects that it had on Germany and Austria-Hungary and Russia and the Ottoman Empire really well, and helped to explain why there was so much kind of hatred left over after the end of the war, and a sense of betrayal by people who survived, especially in Germany, especially in the German army. Tom, do you want to add anything?
So I'm not sure if it counts against me so much, but I did, as I think I mentioned, I did end up listening to most of this on an audio book format. And as I said, it was quite entertaining that for whatever reason, the narrator decided to try and mimic like the accent of whoever he was trying to quote, and it's quite entertaining when he got to the more famous ones. So like the like he tried to like affect an American accent for some of the American speakers, and then also he did a pretty good Churchill impression as well. Don't know who's asking for this. I suppose it's a step up from like some of these recordings where they mispronounce the names of the people, which I mean, you think you'd make some effort to try and learn the pronunciation, but there you go. I'm not in the business. Yeah, so I'm not entirely sure where I should step in with some of these things, but you talked about so basically, as you said, the Germans or the sort of Lenin's what ended up to culminating the Russian Revolution with Lenin was sponsored by the German government. Like they transported him into Russia and also provided him with the resources to sort of kickstart that movement. And I suppose it could be likened very much to British French support the Arab uprisings in the Ottoman Empire. Although obviously different means, different outcomes there. I suppose it's also like what's interesting is I so obviously was aware of the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk and it being, comparatively quite harsh terms, all things considered. And obviously the question is why, and I think this book kind of addresses quite well, and it certainly was an argument I was aware of, and it was that Lenin kind of, I suppose you could call it, was playing like 4D chess, in that he kind of, within reason, was happy to agree to these terms, both to consolidate the tenuous position of the Bolsheviks at the time, and also kind of, rightly or wrongly, I think, I mean, this book, it kind of wrongly, in the short term at least, kind of Lenin's understanding that by agreeing to these terms, it also allowed him to have a more aggressive foreign policy further down the line to sort of spread the sort of international communist movement, which at least at that point in time was kind of the foreign policy they were trying to enact. Yeah, I think that's most of the things I have to say at this part.
Yeah, I agree with that. I thought it was an interesting take on that situation. I have to say I didn't appreciate at all that Germany had sponsored Lenin and helped ferry him back into Russia with the express intention of destabilizing the Russian government during the First World War. It was particularly it just seemed very ironic to me given how opposed Germany became to Bolshevism in the interwar years and during the Second World War, of course, as well. It seems surprising that they had backed him at that point when arguably they had the opportunity not to and to avoid that. But yeah, the Lenin's thinking in agreeing to the terms of Brest-Litovsk was quite interesting, and it was well laid out in this book. And also I think that I don't remember actually if this was part of his thinking or just a result of the treaty, which was accidentally achieved, but by signing peace with the Central Powers, it meant that Russia released hundreds of thousands of prisoners who back into Germany and Austria-Hungary, who had taken the ideas of Bolshevism with them and effectively ended up destabilizing their own countries and their own governments when they returned. I think we read in Ring of Steel that actually contributed to quite harsh treatment of returning prisoners by at least the Austro-Hungarians. Yeah. In terms of what else I wanted to add about this theme, I thought that it was well chosen. It was important to kind of introduce the morale element to the situation in Eastern Europe in the post-war years after the First World War, because as Gavart points out in his book, there was so much expectation of victory after the Russian surrender and after the Russian defeat in 1917. And then with the build-up in Germany for Operation Michael, the 1918 Spring Offensive, and the Austro-Hungarian successes against Italy, and even to an extent, at that point, the Ottomans had won the first two battles of Gaza and were holding their front against the British. So there were high hopes that were dashed completely in a very short space of time, and that really contributed to this sense of betrayal, I guess, among the populations, and particularly among the soldiers of those countries who had sacrificed so much and given so much of themselves to the cause of victory, and then it being kind of snatched away from them, and particularly in Germany as well, because that had taken place via a revolution of the sailors. And then obviously there was the fact that because the Kaiser and his government all resigned, it was kind of left to the liberal SDP to take over, step into the gap, and they were then blamed for the subsequent bad peace, I suppose, that Germany made at Versailles by the army who felt that they'd been they'd been defeated from within, really.
Yeah, I think that's true. I was basically because the sort of defeat. I suppose the fact that it's talking about defeat, obviously, it's talking about powers that weren't on the winning side for it, by definition. But I mean, so it's like this experience of defeat was not entirely. It really depend. I mean, so it wasn't entirely universal, I guess you could say, right? Because you obviously had the powers that, represented the combatants and were also on like the receiving end of some sort of settlement, or had to sort of officially sort of sign off some settlement. But you have some nations, particularly like Poland and Czechoslovakia, who, I mean, at the times comprised some of the combatant nations, but obviously weren't represented politically, perhaps to the same extent. And to a certain extent, the defeat in quotes, I suppose, was more of a empowering sort of process, or like a empowering settlement, in that it led to some sort of identity and self-determination. But I think, I mean, probably going to come to this a bit later.
Yeah, I think that is covered in the third theme of the book, the collapse of the 19th century empires. But it is a good point that, the defeat was defeat for the kind of Central Powers and Russia, but not for a lot of the other nations that emerged from the post-war period. Although I suppose with Poland, I don't remember this from the book, and maybe I'm conflating from Ring of Steel, but there was a kind of sense of betrayal among Polish nationalists, wasn't there? Because I think there was, because both Austro-Hungary and Germany had made concessions to Polish nationalists to try to recruit them for the war against Russia, and when those powers collapsed, they kind of had to, assert that right again, after having already, agreed it with one power. They found themselves in a new kind of situation, which I guess created some instability as well.
I guess I yeah I don't remember that exactly, but I think it's picked up a bit later in the book, sure.
Should we move on to the second theme?
Yeah.
Do you wanna read it or introduce it?
Sure. Yeah, so the second part of the book deals what is titled Revolution and Counter-Revolution. And just going through Sam's notes, this book, or this part of the book, primarily deals with the Russian Revolution and spread of communist activities outside of Russia, as well as I mean, so the counter movement to this, as particularly like German success, the successive German governments trying to contain this activity, both within Germany and sort of further afield in Eastern Europe. As part of the sort of Russian Revolution, it talks about the subsequent Russian civil war between what are usually termed the Reds and the Whites, which was incredibly destructive. It led to and deaths in excess of 3 million people, which compares, quite unfavorably with an estimated 1.7 million who died as a result of the First World War. I assume these are military casualties. I don't actually know what these numbers correspond to. So in terms of like Reds and Whites, it's a bit of a well, I suppose it's a bit of a, what would you say, bit of a model comparison, because the Reds were, although they did comprise not just the Bolsheviks, they're a much more unified sort of fighting force, political force, compared to the Whites, who represented conservative elements loyal to, sort of monarchical rule, I suppose, but sort of not a bit further afield. So much more fragmented, sort of, to not a completely fair comparison between the two. And this can be credited as one of the key reasons why the Reds eventually triumphed over the Whites. And then we have a similar sort of outbreaks of violence, civil wars across Eastern Europe and also Finland. I guess that's not included in Eastern Europe. Finland, although that was much, much more, although it was relatively brief, it was incredibly, comparatively quite bloody, although it was resolved within the course of a year or less than a year. And yeah, so this sort of, as sort of been hinted above, this outbreak of violence from, say, the Russian Revolution sort of spread across Europe, and it sort of lent itself to this fear of a quote contagion of Bolshevik ideas. And this particularly felt within Germany, which is partly attributed to the rise in the Freikorps sort of formations, which were mostly sort of veterans of the First World War who were perhaps on the right side of, not the right side, the right wing side of politics, who saw it as both their duty as well as sort of being somewhat opportunistic in trying to sort of make a living out of the sort of fear of Bolshevism, this outbreak of violence in Eastern Europe. Do-do-do-do-do. This is me reading through notes. I think, I mean, there's other elements I can go into. So basically, I think what was interesting from this, so apart from not really being so aware of the roots of this mobilization of sort of paramilitary groups, especially in Germany, or at least seem most evident in Germany as a consequence of the instability following the First World War. But I don't know if it necessarily was the case, but it certainly came across as though the sort of initial popular uprisings in a lot of these countries were generally along sort of socialist and communist lines. And it seemed like the second sort of group of like counter movements were much more sort of right wing conservative in nature. And that was certainly seemed to be the case in, say, like Germany and Hungary, I think, where there was actually communist government in place, and that was quite quickly replaced by a sort of right-wing conservative movement, and actually a monarchical movement. I actually that reminds me actually. So one of the big questions we always have about World War II is why on earth does Hungary, a landlocked nation, have as its head of government a guy with the title Admiral, Admiral Horthy, of course. And the reason was, as I think this book mentioned, is that he was actually a First World War naval officer, obviously admiral. And so he just, I suppose, he retained the title. I just thought no one noticed. I don't really know the details there, but I thought it was quite funny because it was it in this book? He said like how he like pledged his loyalty to the Austro-Hungarian crown moments before surrendering, and yeah, so yeah. Obviously, like perhaps a bit of a low bar after that, but yeah, anyway, nonetheless.
Yeah, as an awkward moment, I'm sure. Yeah, that's I think you're right in that, like, the a lot of the initial kind of revolution activity was on the left, on inspired by Bolshevism and socialism, and that then led to kind of reactionary elements on the right, escalating the violence as well as they're trying to kind of stamp out those revolutions or those attempts to establish communes or self-governing kind of regions. And that was definitely the case in Germany, where I think Gerhard mentions the Spartacist rising in Berlin, as well as the short-lived Bavarian Soviet Republic, which had kind of an effect on Hitler, I believe. I think he makes a point in his book that that kind of like scared Hitler towards the right, and it kind of created this initial hatred of Bolshevism that carried through all the way into his dictatorship, having experienced the revolution in Bavaria. But it led to pretty extreme and brutal kind of repression by these is they Freikorps forces or Freikorps, I'm not sure how you pronounce it.
I think it would be for, I mean, doesn't really matter. This,
Okay.
I mean, the alternative name for this podcast should be like the Bad German like hour. Also,
Yeah.
I mean, fair enough, kind of.
Mispronunciation time.
Yeah, I mean, butcher most languages on this podcast as well. So.
Yeah, it's pretty terrible. Even English most of the time. But yeah, so I found it interesting because I was fascinated by this concept of the Uber Ost that we discovered, or that I discovered at least, in Ring of Steel, or has kind of like a swathe of Lithuania, largely Lithuania, and Courland as well, which were taken over by the German Empire during the First World War, and run as a kind of almost a separate fief by Hindenburg and Linden. Who was the other one?
Ludendorff, I guess, if
Ludendorff,
that's your
yes.
thing.
Hindenburg and Ludendorff, who
Never
then
forget the third OHL.
yes, exactly. Yeah, so I was kind of interested to learn more about that area, because in the Ring of Steel, Alexander Watson portrays this kind of really nightmarish scenario where people are being impressed into working camps and forced to build roads and railways and infrastructure, and food is just kind of requisitioned at a whim from the populations and distributed back to Germany. And then at the end of that book, he doesn't really, I didn't feel that I may be misremembering, but it didn't seem to me that he concluded that period at all. He didn't give us any indication of what happened to the Uber-Ost. And I was glad that The Vanquished does kind of carry that story a little bit further, in that a socialist government took over in the aftermath of the First World War, only to be reinvaded by Germany and the Freikorps, who then kind of brutally put down, or attempted to put down, the Lithuanian resistance. And it was only, I think it was only as a result of support by the Soviets that the Lithuanian government were able to kind of force at least a stalemate, and eventually the Freikorps kind of retired back into Germany. But yeah, it was an interesting chapter or theme of the book, and I think that for me it kind of incorporated the main thrust of the book, which was the instability that kind of arose from the breakdown of governments across Eastern Europe, and the idea that this was this influx of both extreme left and right wing ideologies that caused an explosion of violence, where people were fighting on ideological grounds, and there were, you know, reprisals and counter reprisals and attempts to assassinate or silence political enemies. It just kind of created a civil war type situation in most of Eastern Europe, where you know, countrymen were turned on each other, and for me, I felt that was the kind of the key factor that made Eastern Europe so unstable in the post-war period. Did you think that as well? Did you get that theme and idea?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, because like consistent within this, right? Is, I mean, it's not, I suppose, particularly new from this book, but you know, this idea that there was just like a general upheaval in society due to the First World War, that you have all of this you know, conflicts coming out in the consequence. But I suppose the interesting thing, or this, you know, the other element is like, quite often there's a sense that you know, one of the key problems with, you know, the settlement following the First World War is that there's this idea of self-determination. I mean, this is dealt with in the third part of the book more so, but like this idea of self-determination as being like one of the like key destabilizing factors. But it seems like it's a bit further beyond that, because it's not just a case of having all these nations strive for statehood following the First World War, but it's also the fact that the governments or whatever sort of political force that's in power following the First World War is really unable to sort of police effectively, or able to sort of maintain a peaceful situation, which is much just as much of an element as well. So for instance, you have these like paramilitary groups essentially sort of being on loan to like other countries, or like making their own sort of living in other countries, which is a destabilizing factor quite separate to this sort of like struggle for statehood, which I haven't really picked up on quite so much.
Yeah.
I also think I don't know which part it's dealt with, but like it does bring up Italy,
yeah.
And obviously this is kind of an exception in both cases, because I mean, although it did start off as allied to the Central Powers, it ended up fighting on the side of the Allies, so obviously it was at the winner's table. But I think it's quite frequently stated that like there's this general sort of dissatisfaction with the settlement. It doesn't seem to achieve the war aims that it set out for itself, and this is credited as being why, despite being at the winner's table, it sort of breaks down. You have the rise of fascism under Benito Mussolini, and like one of the questions, I mean, it doesn't really satisfactorily answer the question why, but like one of the sort of answers it gives to this is that, certainly new to me, was that there was this interwar agreement between France, the UK and Italy as to like what Italy could hope to achieve as a result of winning in the First World War. And it is kind of out of that there are these sort of promised sort of territorial gains that are not realized to quite the same extent in the post-war settlement, which is like why there was a general dissatisfaction, why there was like this need to sort of question the authorities that sort of brought them into this conflict and like what the sacrifice was for. I also quite like the fact you've written that Mussolini contracted syphilis during the First World War. That seems like quite a critical finding.
I wrote that down. I wrote that down because it surprised and didn't surprise me at the same time. It was kind of like in the chapter that deals with Italy and the rise of fascism there, he mentions that during the Battle of Caporetto, Mussolini, who did join the Italian army and did fight during the First World War, but he was on sick leave at that period, having contracted syphilis. I think it kind of like sums up my estimation of the right wing, I suppose, that he's just kind of, you know, this supposed store for you know, conservative values, and yet he manages to contract syphilis during the First World War. It's that essential hypocrisy. Yeah, so I thought it was worth mentioning.
It does seem odd. It's actually funny now I remember. So I also read Man in the High Tower recently. It's not a very good book. But so you know the premise, right? It's like a parallel universe where the Nazis and the Japanese, well, the Axis powers like win. And there's like this brief aside that like Hitler is now in an insane asylum. and it's like it's like implies that he also has developed syphilis because of his like wild years in Vienna. So yeah, maybe that's I mean, obviously it's not like a million miles away from what may have happened, but yeah, it's just a little funny.
Yeah, no, it's art imitating life.
Right, well, exactly, yeah.
At least in the transmission of syphilis among the upper echelons of fascist governments.
I mean, you don't need, what's it they like have on their recruitment posters, you don't need syphilis to join us, but it helps. Maybe, yeah. Maybe. Anyway.
Oh, God, you made me laugh now. Yeah, so that also, Givarth also links the rise of fascism in Italy to inspiring Hitler as well in his aborted march on Munich, which we spoke about in the Hitler myth as well, and the kind of fallout from that, but it kind of inspired that initial outburst of enthusiasm that was then curtailed by the authorities. But yeah, did you have anything else to kind of add to this part, or should we move on?
Not really. I kind of more interested in the final part. But yeah, like, yeah, just to say, as you said, like the success of the March from Rome by Mussolini and the fascist movement that directly inspire, or like Hitler directly credits that for his inspiration for the Beer Hall Putsch, which obviously ended quite badly, or at least in the short term. That seems to be a bit of an inflection point in his political life. But yeah, that's that for that.
Okay. So part three of the book covers the theme Imperial Collapse. So this charts the collapse of power, of the imperial powers in Eastern Europe, and the subsequent rise of nations often defined along ethnic or racial lines. The new powers vied with one another for territory and resources in an attempt by their leaders to establish legitimacy. The post-war treaties of Versailles, Saint-Germain, Anlay, Neuilly, Trianon, and Sèvres were widely perceived as unjust among the populations of the former Central Powers. The nations who had fought against the Entente, or now the Allies, lost large swathes of territory to their neighbours and were saddled with huge war reparations debts. The 10-point roadmap to peace, which US President Woodrow Wilson had laid out before the end of the war, raised high hopes for many peoples in Eastern Europe that their national identities would be protected in the new order. These hopes were largely dashed for the nationalities belonging to the defeated powers. The uncertainty and difficulty of realizing Wilson's principles in Eastern Europe, where ethnic groups had previously coexisted in vast multi-ethnic empires, led to increasing violence as newly founded nations attempted to occupy territory in order to claim the gains of in future treaty negotiations. This aggression boiled over into ethnic violence as tensions within communities rose. So, yeah, this final part of the book really deals with the collapse of authority in Eastern Europe in the post-war years and the violence that erupted as nation states and particularly nation states defined along ethnic lines kind of flooded into the gap to try to carve out their own states in the former imperial territories. And yeah, Tom, as you were saying, that's a kind of point that you were most interested in the book. Did you have any points to discuss?
I do, in fact. Surprising. So yeah, so I suppose like this book is structured in a bit of a weird way because it kind of retreads the same periods like a few different times, but this way is mostly dealing with the post-war treaties. So I mean there's a few interesting things. So basically, like, it kind of makes a point. I think this kind of been retread a few times, but you know, the Versailles Treaty is often seen as like highly like unjust, or at least was obviously like presented by the German right at the time as being like profoundly like unjust and like disproportionate in its requirements. But you know, as this book says and many others say, you know, the Germans got off relatively light in terms of reparations and especially in terms of territorial losses. So with you know, Austria and Hungary, it led to the dissolution of the empire into multiple multi-ethnic states. With the Ottoman Empire, it obviously led to the collapse of the Ottoman Empire as an entity. Well, I mean, there were, as we sort of covered in the Ottoman book we read, it obviously sort of split apart what was the Ottoman Empire. Turkey as a nation kind of came a bit separate to that. And also, I mean, it's an interesting point. I think he says like Bulgaria perhaps had suffered like disproportionately the worst in terms of like material and financial sort of reparations that were required of it. I didn't particularly know why, yeah, that was an interesting point. I suppose it's the real thing. So basically, as we were saying before, like a lot of the issues with this post-war settlement sort of relate to Wilson's 14 points program, and it sort of there was like a general sort of discontent on multiple sides as to how these were like actually realized, because there was this big emphasis on sort of unifying you know, sort of peoples around sort of national statehood, like a true sort of nation state. But as those were to play out, they didn't really represent the reality of the situation on the ground. So you had multiple situations where a territory could potentially be split between multiple different countries, but for you know, political reasons, it was, you know, advantageous to deny, say, the Germans or the Austrians in favor of some other state, and then potentially there had to be a choice between like other competing states as well. So I think that was a situation where there was a territory that could be split between either Czechoslovakia, Poland, or Germany, for multiple reasons. And I still don't really understand what the sort of motivation was between this 14 points program beyond just you know, purely ideological grounds, because And my only thought around this was that potentially both because of like the time of history we're dealing with, we're moving away from sort of absolute monarchies towards sort of democratic rule, as well as the fact that obviously United States at this point is democratic republic, that maybe there's a push towards nation like nationhoods around like defined peoples in favor of say like monarchs, just because of this sort of like political sort of preference or like political sort of understanding they're working with. But I don't really understand because you think like, well, I mean, fair enough that you have multiple like cases both within say like British India and within the Ottoman Empire where there wasn't a great deal of consideration put towards like the actual practical implementation of some of these treaties, but it's still unclear why, beyond just general optimism, like what why that there wasn't more thought given to what these nation states should look like and what they should like coalesce around. And it's quite often in multiple cases, as the author goes on to say, like these countries were not sort of nation states unified around like a single people. They generally, even like the smaller states, especially Yugoslavia, that they were effectively multi-ethnic, like quote, many empires in their own right, despite these principles, or what an interpretation of these principles could be taken to understand as.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I have to say, I don't think that that is dealt with in any of the books that we've read covering the period. But I always assumed that it was driven in part by ideological grounds for the Allies, and particularly America, that they wanted to recreate the kind of democratic nation state that they had in other parts of the world. But I also kind of thought that it might have been a deliberate attempt to destabilize or delegitimize the monarchical governments in the imperial powers. So, like Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Ottoman Empire were all ruled by emperors or kings or sultans. And Wilson's 14 points were kind of directed more at the population to try to win them over and put the governments of those central power countries in a position where they had to negotiate for peace. That was my understanding, or that was my interpretation, but I don't know. It's not really based on anything that we read. It's also a really interesting point that you made, that the Bulgarians ended up being well, suffering the most in terms of territorial loss, war reparations in comparison to their kind of like relative size. And I wonder if that's because they kind of like they initially fought against Turkey for their own independence, and they fought with Serbia and Greece, and then they kind of change sides, and I wonder if that's the issue that is at stake. They wanted to kind of there was a maybe a political necessity to kind of punish them for that decision.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's probably just more like proportionally it would be harsher just because it's a smaller economy or something. That I don't know exactly. I think also so there are two other things I want to just talk about. So it was quite really interesting. So we kind of like this before. So basically there's a lot of discontent around how these 14 points were applied, and it gave a lot of credence to a lot of the populist sort of irredentist movements as well, which would culminate, to a certain extent in World War II. But what was an interesting point, I think he said it, hopefully not just making this up, but like how the union between Germany and Austria, which had, well, at least in like modern history, had like a precedent in the 1848 uprising, or revolutions, during this period of time sort of started off as more left-wing policy, And it was only obviously later down the line that it became sort of a hallmark of like right-wing policies once like the political situation changed a bit. And I thought that was really interesting. Never really heard of that before.
Yeah, I think it is an interesting conclusion and a point to make.
Yeah, I know we're kind of running out of time here. But there was one thing also. So basically, he brings up. So obviously, we talked about like there was a civil war in Finland, which was relatively quite bloody but quite short-lived. But between Finland and Czechoslovakia, by the time of the 1930s coming around, they're basically the only surviving democracies in continental Europe. That have emerged out of this new political situation. And it's not really clear why. I don't really know if there's any particular situation, a particular reason why, given in the book. I can't really recall. And it's a particularly interesting case of Czechoslovakia because it seems like the least likely candidate of this, given that it's like right next to Germany. No offense, Germany. But it's also similar to Poland and Yugoslavia, described as a multi-ethnic state as well. So Czechoslovakia at this point comprises Czechs, Slovaks, Germans, and Ruthenes. So it's not an obvious candidate for stabilization. And as he goes on to say, it does take on the character of similar to the previous Austro-Hungarian state, where there's quite a clear sort of preference towards the majority Czech peoples versus the other peoples. But yeah, I don't know why particularly democracy seems to thrive in this particular country.
Yeah, I don't think that that's covered in the book either. I don't remember that being covered. This is a really interesting point. I wonder, I mean, my only thought, and this is completely off the cuff, but I wonder if because of the, very varied multi-ethnic kind of character of Czechoslovakia, that democracy was the kind of only way to hold those territories together to kind of create a national consensus rather than having kind of one very obviously dominant group who kind of were able to impose their own ideology. But I'm not sure.
I don't know either. I mean, the only other thing he mentions is that Czechoslovakia is kind of characterized as a bit of a favorite amongst the French and British governments, but I don't really know. I mean, obviously that ended up in complete disaster, but that's for another time.
Yeah. 'Kay, so those are the three key themes of the book. And I'm just going to talk very briefly, both of us, about our concluding thoughts. I mean, from my perspective, I really enjoyed the book. I thought it was a vastly complicated story, really well written, and told in quite a short number of pages as well. I enjoyed it a lot, and I appreciated the kind of brevity of it as well. The lack of tables for everything was amazing. I mean, I'm divided. As Tom knows, I'm divided between loving and loathing tables. Sometimes they're useful, but most of the time I think they just drag. But I would definitely recommend the book. I think it's a great introduction to this period. Certainly, a lot of what he covered, Gavath, was news to me. And I also wanted to say as well that if you've been listening to our other podcasts, want to read those books, then there's a theme kind of starting to emerge where, like, Ring of Steel, The Vanquished, The Fall of the Ottomans could, and the Hitler myth in particular, could all kind of like feed into each other and help to get a kind of quite a good picture of the Eastern Europe in the first and post-World War world.
Yeah, just to add on to that. So yeah, I did enjoy this. I think, as I may have indicated, my experience was greatly enhanced by the audiobook format that I was following for most of the time. But I mean, in fairness, I did read like at least a third of it, so I think it
I
totally
read at least
counts.
one third.
Well, at least, oh, I don't know it exactly. I was in I wasn't giving it the time that I perhaps should have. In fairness, I think the only thing is well, it's not the only thing. I mean there's two things basically. It's obviously more of a popular sort of history, not an academic history. So when it says, it has poses what, the question, obviously the subtitle, like why the First World War failed to end, doesn't really answer that question. Obviously it's not going to be that kind of book, but yeah, it doesn't just kind of explores that, and there's some interesting points. I suppose also relatedly is that the ending of the book, I mean, it takes the year 1923. Admittedly, that's quite arbitrary. I think the author says that. So the 1923 year, I think is taken because it's the year in which the Lausanne Conference takes place, which is the sort of post-war settlement between the newly emerged Turkish nation and the Greeks and allies. And that's kind of a counterpoint to this sort of otherwise sort of decline and fall of the successor states out of the fallen or the central powers. So this is kind of a like resurgence of the new Turkish nation state. But I mean can't really hold it against it. I mean, there's sort of discussed years from that, as in like how this feeds into, say, like Hitler's political career, and also a bit further afield as well. But yeah, I did like this. Would recommend it, and I think similarly, this is not something I'm certainly not a period of history I'm especially familiar with, especially in a sort of broader sense outside of, say, Germany or the UK. So yeah, there's quite a lot that I picked up on that was new to me as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, like you say, it's not really an academic book, but I do find it quite useful if I'm getting into a period of history to read a couple of more introductory books first and then kind of delve into the specific academic areas that I'm more interested in. But yeah. Do you want to talk a little bit about your choice for our next review?
Indeed, yes. So yeah, you may have heard Simon likes some tables. So he'll be happy to know, or has he soon quite discovered. The next book is all about tables. So we're going to be reading Enduring the Whirlwind, which is a sort of re-examination of the military situation between, or the military conflict on the Eastern Front between Nazi Germany and the Axis, or the tripartite nations, and the Soviets between 1941 and 1943. And it's kind of trying to, well, I don't know, spoilers maybe. It's trying to sort of like re-examine the sort of common sort of argument that the Germans and allies, for all the best of intentions, weren't able to sort of deal with like the swathes of like Soviet forces that kind of just washed over them, and it was just sheer brute force that basically decided the conflict, especially during that period of time when it was a bit more level pegging, so to speak. But yeah, so as another consistent theme of our podcast, Simon has already finished the book. I'm yet to finish the book, and so it's kind of waiting on me to get things finished.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, and certainly if you enjoyed our mispronunciations of words in this episode, you're going to love the Enduring the Whirlwind episode, as it includes several highly technical German terms for various army formations and status of units.
Oh yeah, the glossary is quite intense read by itself, so yeah.
You know that you've got a detailed book when it comes with, the first page is a glossary of terms of German military kind of formations. It's but it's interesting.
No, sorry. I did find myself, because it's like quite often you have like on this like like so a few like YouTube channels to watch, like they say like, oh, so many people in the field. But now I'm asking myself, well, like which number are they going by? Like I need to know the specific technical name.
Well, yeah,
Otherwise, I
exactly.
can't take this seriously anymore.
Exactly. Now you know, the more you know. Also, I have a question or a couple of questions. Is this available on, is Enjoying the Whirlwind available as an audiobook? And if so, do they do accents?
Well, you'd be happy to know, yes, it is available, but I didn't buy it because I used my Audible credit for another book, which I was a lecture series I didn't end up listening to. Oh, I did a bit. It's quite interesting, but it wasn't quite what I expected. So, it was this is not sponsored, by the way. But it was a great Courses Plus lecture series, and it was something like 1215, the year that changed the world. And it had a picture. I think the front is like King John, and I thought, oh, okay, it's obviously going to be about the Magna Carta. But as it turned out, it was about like different events in and around 1215 that are
Right.
like quite disparate otherwise. But it does talk about Magna Carta, although I haven't listened to that much of it. But it's quite interesting because I do sound like the hypocrite maybe, but although I only really like modern history, I do end up listening to bits and pieces of other stuff. And it was quite interesting because it was talking about how what ended the expansion of the Mongol Empire may have been some sort of small scale sort of climate change in this period of history, which made the farming land in Mongolia especially much more profitable, and so it led to less of this need to spread further afield, or at least that's like one theory.
Wasn't that the mini ice age? I thought that was the period of the mini ice age. The
I don't
or
know.
no, I don't know.
I'm just telling people what I'm also talking of the Magna Carta. So I don't actually, because they say like there's only four surviving versions of it.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if that. I'm assuming it could. So when I was in the Guildhall a few weeks ago in the City of London, I actually saw the version. It's a bit actually. It must be not included in this set of four, right? Because it was actually a later Magna Carta signed by Edward the First or something. But it's interesting in this one because I think it's the one. The only Magna Carta that I think specifically mentions the City of London, which is why they had it on display. It's quite, I mean, I don't read Latin, so I just take their word for it. But yeah, it's quite interesting to see it from that point of view. Yeah.
Yeah, because I guess at that point, Edward the First was 13th century. I suppose London was emerging as a kind of real political power in its own right, I guess. But yeah,
I
I
think,
didn't know that was a
yeah, so, sorry. I mean, so it's like the City of London as a political entity, like, has roots way back because obviously it was founded in the first century AD.
Yeah, but until that point, it was kind of like it was often under the sway of various other, like in the Anglo-Saxon period, it kind of alternated between Mercia and Wessex. They didn't
Okay.
really have that, you know, that well, there were the jury is out, at least in the books that I've read, that whether or not it had any kind of autonomy or autonomous power.
Would that be in the City of London, or would that be Aldwych?
City of London, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Wow.
Enough.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, I think I answered that. So basically, there is an audiobook version of this, but I haven't got
Great, okay. Well then, I mean that's good to know, at least. But we don't know if there are accents. If there are, it would be interesting, I'm sure.
it. Good job, yeah.
Well, thank you for listening, and please tune in again next time for Enjoying the Whirlwind.